Good morning. May it please the court. Oliver Hall for the appellants, Libertarian Party. The issue in this case is whether the Constitution permits the District of Columbia to treat a class of valid votes unequally by failing to report the identity of the candidate for whom they were cast in order to save time and money. The district court held that the district may do so, provided it determines that the votes are not outcome determinative. This was an error. There is no precedent for the district court's outcome determinative standard, and it contradicts well-settled Supreme Court precedent protecting the right to vote, the right to associate for political purposes, and the right to equal protection under law.
Mr. Hall, what's your answer to the district's argument that you can get the ballots under FOIA and count them yourselves?
Well,
or put them up on the internet and let somebody else count them?
Your Honor, the first answer to that is that the Supreme Court has held in Bullock v. Carter and in Lubin v. Panish that the state may not require candidates and voters to shoulder the financial burden of holding elections. And so it would violate Supreme Court precedent to make the libertarians pay the cost of tabulating and counting their own votes. The second answer I would give
is... The whole thing has to do with, it's just a question of the cost of... So you agree you get the numbers, the ballots, and the only question is counting, and the First Amendment requires the District of Columbia to spend the money on the counting rather than you? That's it?
No, Your Honor. The second part of that answer is that by treating these votes unequally, they're stigmatizing the libertarians from the outset of the election.
We don't know if it's libertarians, right? We don't know.
They're
stigmatizing the write-ins, maybe.
That's correct, Your Honor. But I would like to point out the distinction that's important in this case, which is that we're not talking about all write-in votes. We're talking about write-in votes for a candidate who had filed papers pursuant to District of Columbia law and became a ballot-qualified write-in candidate. That's different from, for example, the case in Burdick v. Takushi, where the plaintiff in that case was asserting a right to vote for Donald Duck. We're not talking about that. We're talking about a valid vote for a ballot-qualified candidate. And here, the district's policy is stigmatizing that candidate by treating votes for the candidate unequally, by saying...
All of your other arguments that were in the brief, that is, all the arguments about expressive value of the vote and the knowing how the vote came out, those are all, you've dropped all of those and you've left only with the equal protection argument?
No, certainly not, Your Honor. We have a First Amendment argument, we have an equal protection argument.
That's not an equal protection argument? I understand the equal protection argument.
The First Amendment, and I would like to return to the expressive value point, but I would say it's not as important.
Is there any case that supports you on your equal protection theory?
Sure, Your Honor. There are multiple cases.
Not your First Amendment theory, but the equal, that the district is treating write-in ballots differently from other ballots?
Right. Well, we did cite...
What says it?
We did cite several cases in the briefs, and mm-hmm. Gray v. Sanders was one of them. The district court said, well, that case has no relevance because that's a vote dilution case. Mm-hmm. But just because the facts are not identical does not mean that the principle of equal protection does not apply in this case, whereas it does in Gray v. Sanders. The court said in Gray v. Sanders, you cannot treat a class of valid votes unequally, and that's certainly going on in this case. Now, granted, in Gray v. Sanders, the unequal treatment involved treating some votes, giving some votes more voting power. Mm-hmm. But here, there is also a burden and an unequal burden by stigmatizing the votes for the libertarians.
Well, it's only treated unequally because the appellant didn't get a sufficient number of votes to have them counted. I mean, if he had had a sufficient number of votes, if there had been a sufficient number of write-in ballots to be counted under the regulations, they would have been counted, right?
And so this comes to...
So it's only because he didn't get enough votes.
And so this comes to
to
the district court's principle that these votes can be treated unequally on the basis that they're not outcome determinative. But this is really not a principle that has any basis in the Constitution, and certainly no basis in precedent. None has been cited by the district court. None has been cited by...
Can we just go back to the basic legal principle that controls this? Do you agree that there's a balancing test here, that the heavier the burden on the voters on the voter, on the candidate, the heavier the burden is on the city to justify, right?
That's correct.
Okay, so if we conclude that the burden is light here, that the burden is fairly insignificant, then don't the courts, don't the decisions say that the city's administrative needs and costs can outweigh that, right?
Well, Your Honor, I think that's a fact-intensive question, and before I would concede that point, I would have to dispute the characterization of the burden here as light. There is no light burden here. These candidates and these voters and the candidate and the party itself is being stigmatized. The district court says, oh, the Libertarians are free to win elections in the District of Columbia. But how are they ever going to do that when institutionalized by law is the unequal treatment that everybody knows from the outset of the election? That the votes cast for this party are not going to be reported unless...
Well, that's not true if they have enough.
Your Honor, I was about to say, unless they win enough votes to win the election.
But again, your
killing the seeds of democracy.
Your theory is that people aren't voting for the appellant because they know the votes might not be counted? Is that your theory?
I think, if Your Honor, if
is
the question...
There's no record evidence about that at all, is it?
If the question is... Are people less likely to vote for a candidate if they know that the votes are not likely to be reported, the outcome of the votes are not likely to be reported? The answer must be yes. And I would simply suggest to Your Honor to consider whether you would vote for a candidate if you knew that there was, in all likelihood, your vote would not be reported on an equal basis as all other votes. Your Honor most likely would not cast a vote for that candidate, and I would say that is true for everybody. People are not going to cast votes.
Wait a minute. I just want to make sure your argument. Your proposition is that since I wouldn't, no one else would? Where do you get the evidence about me?
Excuse my presumption.
It seems to me that a candidate could, in fact, use that to his advantage. You know, look, we got to get a lot of people out to get the votes counted. It could work the other way.
That is a very optimistic theory, but
well,
Your Honor,
the point is, there's no record evidence on this at all, correct?
Let's just back up, and I apologize for presuming the likelihood of the outcome of what you would do in the voting booth.
I would say that
I think it's true that most people are going to be less likely to vote for a candidate if they know from the outset that their votes are going to be treated unequally by thrown in an anonymous pile as generic write-in votes for whoever. Than they would if they knew that the outcome of their vote is going to be treated equally and reported equally with every other vote. And that's the point here. And so let's get back to the First Amendment
issue. Also the case that people might do that if they're their candidate is a write-in candidate as compared to a candidate with a line on the ballot?
Your Honor, I think it is true that a write-in candidate is a burden. It's more difficult probably to win an election as a write-in candidate, but that does not mean
and that's perfectly lawful, though, right?
Well, it's lawful to allow write-in votes, yes.
No, but it's lawful to distinguish between write-ins. That every person who qualifies as a write-in doesn't have to have their own line.
Well, I think the point of a write-in vote is that you can write in the name of any candidate you want. In this case, however,
For example, your candidate doesn't have enough votes to get, or in the last, I don't know exactly how this was done, but I assume in the last election, to get a line with his name on it. Not a write-in line, but
right.
A line with his name on it, right?
In order to do that, you have to submit a certain number of signatures.
Right, and it's... And
1%.
1%.
And I take it that your view is that people are less likely to vote for a person who doesn't have a line with his name on it than one who you'd have to write in, correct?
I'm sorry. Please clarify.
Yeah. The argument you made with respect to Judge Tatel's personal views, I'm trying to extend that now. I assume Judge Tatel is less likely to vote for a candidate whose name is not printed on the ballot than he is for one whose name is printed on the ballot.
I think that's probably true.
But that is okay under the First Amendment, correct?
Well, Your Honor, the First Amendment, the 14th...
Under the case law, the First Amendment,
sure,
there's no doubt that that's okay.
There's no requirement that every candidate be treated completely equally. But here, the issue is, we have valid votes, and once there are valid votes, there is no basis under the Constitution for discriminating against some valid votes and not others, or treating these unequally. Consider, based on this case, the District of Columbia could very well say the same thing about votes for Republicans. 93% of the vote went for Barack Obama in 2008. Well, votes for Republicans are certainly not outcome determinative. So let's discriminate against them. We can save some money. We can save some time. The same thing is true and maybe more analogous to this case.
No, but you're missing the point of the city's argument here. It's the city can count, easily count the votes that are on the line, the non-write-in votes. That's not the issue here. They would never have a defense to say, well, it's more... We don't want to count the Republican votes because it's expensive. They just wouldn't. That's not a credible defense. But here their argument is, and they have an affidavit in the record which says that they can count the number of write-in ballots, but to count the actual votes for each candidate would require sorting through thousands of ballot boxes. They would have to hire people. It would take a couple weeks and cost a lot of money.
Okay, so let's think of another example. Overseas ballots cast by military personnel. Those are a significant administrative burden, and they also place an urgency on election disputes when courts have to decide pre-election disputes, and there's a need to get ballots printed, to get them sent overseas, and so on. That places a major administrative burden on the entire electoral process. But nobody would suggest that, you know, it'd just be easier if we don't count the votes that these military personnel cast, because they're not going to be outcome determinative. Nobody would ever suggest that, and no case has ever suggested that. And no case has been cited here that
But a number of states do it this way, right? The same way D.C. does?
Your Honor, I am not
a small number, right?
I'm not aware of any that do. I do know that...
The information in the appendix, I didn't independently check this, but the information in the appendix suggested that a few states do it this way.
I think there may be two. There was one cited Virginia, but that was the board cited an incorrect statute. Virginia does not do that. There may be one or two other states that do, but I would note that
this
has not been challenged,
right,
and it has not been decided by a court.
Right. There are states that don't count absentee ballots if the total number of absentee ballots can't make a difference.
I don't know the answer to that, Your Honor, but I do know that there has been no case that says we're just going to say at the outset of an election that we're not going to count these votes unless there's enough of them to determine that they might determine the outcome of the election.
I think I read that several states, like, won't count challenged ballots, that is, where the person is challenged at the poll and has to come back with ID or something like that, will only count those if it would make a difference. You know anything about those cases?
Well, I'm not familiar with. I don't know unless you cite the name of the case. But I would say.
Well, I don't know if there's a case at all. That's what I'm asking.
Oh.
We're talking about what state procedures were, and that might be somewhat similar. I just
sure
case law now.
I have not heard of any precedent making that distinction. I don't believe that there is one. Again, the distinction there would be that those are then disputed votes, right? And they are not the same. They're not on the same constitutional par as the votes we're talking about here, which are undeniably valid votes cast for a ballot-qualified candidate. And there is no case, I can say with certainty, there is no case that says that the state, in order to save time and money, can treat a class of valid votes unequally in this way.
But the purpose, keep going if you had another point.
Sir. Well, I was just going to return to the First Amendment because
in interpreting the First Amendment, the Supreme Court said the purpose of elections is to determine winners, not as a forum for expression. That's the Timmons case and others. So You don't dispute that the correct winner of D.C.'s electoral votes was determined?
No, I don't, Your Honor. Not
that there was any fraud or mistake in the counting, determining of the winner?
Right, no. We don't dispute that. But Your Honor,
how do you deal then with the Supreme Court's statement that ballots serve primarily to elect candidates, not as forums for political expression?
Because in those cases, Your Honor, Timmons and Burdick, those were cases where the plaintiffs were specifically asserting a right to send a message through their ballot. In Burdick, it was a message that I want to vote for Donald Duck as a protest vote. And in Timmons, it was a fusion case where the voters were trying to say that they had the right to associate with this candidate, even though the candidate was already the nominee of a major party, and they had an expressive interest in making that association. That's different from here. I mean, there are lots of other rights involved in the First Amendment, political association being, I think, the most relevant here. And the point is,
you've talked about the stigma. Beyond stigma, what exact harm is there from not knowing the precise number of votes?
The harm, Your Honor, is that you will never, well, let me qualify my language. It would
harder.
Be very, very unlikely that you would ever successfully start a new political party if you could be stigmatized in this way. If voters know from the outset, votes for this new party are likely not going
to
be reported.
Isn't the way around that, to get enough signatures to get a line on the ballot? Isn't that how you start a...
That's
you
correct,
go
Your
out
Honor,
and hustle and get the signatures on the ballot. It's hard in some states, and it's easier in others.
And hard in this state, in this district.
Right. It's less difficult in this district than in others, where the standards. And if Judge Kavanaugh's point, I think, is that's how you think about the burden, right? I mean, if it's easy to get on the ballot, you only need 1%, then the burden on the candidate is light compared to other cases, and therefore the burden on the district to the vote of the city to justify its action is commensurately light.
Your Honor,
isn't that the way we're supposed to look at this?
We should be clear when we talk about whether this burden is light or heavy. It's a heavy burden relative to almost every other state in the country. 1% may sound reasonable in the abstract, but it's actually more restrictive than all but four states, I believe.
But hasn't the court upheld restrictions that are heavier than this, such as 4 or 5%?
Well, yes, Your Honor, but these statutes and these requirements must be determined in the context of the overall statutory scheme and in the context of the specific facts. So there, as the Supreme Court has said, there's no litmus test, 1%, 2%, 0.5%. But the fact is, it's undisputed in this case that the 1% requirement that the district imposes is more restrictive than all but, I believe, four states.
And that's because it costs a lot of money to get up to that 1%, that is to get the signatures?
Well, Your Honor, there's a lot of reasons. One reason, though, is just that people don't like to be stopped on the street. It's very difficult to collect signatures. It's hard to start a new political party.
Oh, but I still don't understand how hard it is to count the ballots if they give them to you or put them up on the internet, or how expensive it could possibly be to count. There's only, how many, 1,000 or some, 1,500 write-ins, right? Altogether.
In the 2008 election, there were about 1,100.
So how much could it cost to count less than 2,000 pieces?
Your Honor, I would suggest that's a question for the board. It's their job, and the Constitution requires that they do it. It's possible.
Well, your argument is it's too much of a burden on you to do the counting. You said it was too expensive.
But then, Your Honor, if that's their argument, and you're correct that it is, they need to address the language in Carrington v. Rash, which specifically said that states may not casually deprive a class of voters of their voting rights in order to achieve this remote administrative benefit, saving time and saving money. It's never been held to be sufficient to burden the First Amendment rights that are at issue in this case. Never.
They did count the votes, right? They're just not reporting the votes. They did count them.
Right, Your Honor, that's true.
So they're not depriving them of their voting rights.
Well, it's only
the display of the results.
I grant that it's not identical in terms of the fact pattern, but then no case ever is. The principle, however, holds true, that the rights at stake here cannot be burdened on these administrative benefits.
What is the right? First, you were talking about, a moment ago, you were talking about the right to be counted, but they were counted. So now we're only talking about the right to display the results.
The right to have your votes reported on an equal basis with all other valid votes. That is an equal protection argument, but it's also central to the First Amendment rights at issue here. And it goes back to what Judge Kavanaugh was raising just now when we were talking about the difficulty of starting a new political party when it's clear from the outset that the people who may be inclined to support this party are going to have their votes thrown in an anonymous pile and not reported on an equal basis with all other valid votes. So that is a burden on First Amendment rights. It's a burden in terms of the equal treatment. And here, the district court did not even consider this unequal burden. The district court said, well, Anderson says that there's no separate analysis for equal protection claims. But that's an incorrect reading of Anderson. Anderson doesn't say ignore the unequal burden. It simply says that the analytic framework set forth in that case applies to both First Amendment and equal protection claims. Here, the district court never considered the fact that these voters, the libertarians' voting rights, are being unequally burdened. And that was clear error. Especially when you consider that the only thing that the court did consider was this expressive capacity of the votes.
Okay, Mr. Hall, you're way over your time. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Good morning. May it please the Court, Rudolph McGann, attorney for the Board of Elections and Ethics. The central issue of this case is, as delineated in Anderson, is the balancing of the interests between the asserted injury to the appellants with the administrative benefits of the District of Columbia Board of Elections. The right that is being asserted, as far as the board can tell, is that they want to know precisely how well their candidate fared in an election. They know that the candidate did not win the election, and they don't dispute that. However, they want to know exactly how many of the 1,183 write-in votes that their candidate garnered.
Well, Mr. McGann, what's your answer to Mr. Hall's argument that you even have more expenses, savings for the district, if you don't count the Republican votes?
The votes were counted. And
I understand, but if you don't display the results, you go down one column and you find that you have so many more votes for the Democrats that no matter how many votes there were for the Republicans, it doesn't matter. So the district shouldn't have to go to the expense of counting the Republicans.
There wasn't any expense to counting the Republicans at all.
Why is that?
Because they were on the ballot and the machines could accurately tell exactly how many individual itemized votes for Republicans were cast.
Mr. McGann, 20 years ago, there were no machines.
That's correct.
20 years ago, each of these ballots had to be counted by hand. It's probably 5 years ago that was true in the district, but at least 20 years ago. 20 years ago, could the district have made the argument that we're only going to count, we're going to see how many people checked off the Democrats, we're going to count those, and we're not going to waste our time. Or let me put it another way. We're not going to count Ward 7 if all the other wards are enough, right? Could they have done that?
That wasn't done in this case, and
I don't think it could have been done in that case
why 20 years ago.
Why not? What if they went in a situation where you're doing hand counting?
Okay.
And you do the six wards, and there's one person has won for mayor, or maybe one person has won for president, more than all the people who voted in all the remaining wards. Why not stop voting? Why not stop counting them?
I don't think that's not the situation that occurred in this case, and I don't think you could have done that then, because then you would be burdening their right to vote.
Oh,
You'd be burning their right to...
They voted, but there aren't enough of them to make a difference, and you're just not disclosing who voted, who they voted for. And you're saving a lot of money, real money, as compared to this case, which is not real money.
Well, with respect to 20 years ago, when the hand counts were the predominant way of tabulating votes, you wouldn't be able to determine whether or not, I don't believe you'd be able to determine whether or not, even with respect to six wards being counted, whether or not the winner was in that six ward count. You couldn't make a determination. You'd be
President of the United States. You don't think you could make a determination that the votes of the last ward won't make any difference after the first six wards voted, I don't know, 90% for the Democratic
nominee? I don't want to speculate here, but it would cost more to segregate the ballots by ward because they don't come in that way. And
well, they could come in that. You could just count them ward by ward. You could count them at the ward place, and you would save a lot of money not having to count the seventh ward.
I don't believe that we would engage in that exercise.
Why not? Why would that be unconstitutional and this not?
Because, as I stated before, the votes were counted in this contest, and the proposition that you're raising, you wouldn't be counting the votes. The votes were counted; they just weren't reported in the itemized fashion that the appellants would like to have engaged.
They were counted in the sense that we knew how many people voted write-in. Right.
That's correct.
Well, in the situation I'm talking about, we know how many people walked into the polling place, so we know how many votes there were. We just don't bother to look at every ballot to find out how many voted Republican and how many voted Democrat. So why? I mean, every just to continue the hypothetical, every election day when the votes come in from various states, we see on the television 93% of the ballots, you know, of the ballots counted in state X, and we know that there's, you know, up county or down county votes that have not yet come in, but could not change the election.
Correct.
Could the state just say, well, we're not going to count anymore? Won't change the election. We're not going to count anymore.
I don't know how to engage in that hypothetical because that's not what occurred in this scenario.
You can't tell me whether that would be constitutional or not.
To not count votes?
Yeah.
I believe if a vote is cast, it needs to be counted. This and in this situation, the votes were counted. And beyond that, what's being sought after is an itemized report of those votes that were counted.
And on the itemized report, your argument's that it costs too much.
Actually, that's not the extent of the argument. The argument is that with respect to our voting scheme and our statutory scheme, anyone can be a write-in. And the appellants are myopically looking at their own particular circumstance. However, every office on the ballot in a general election or a primary election is susceptible to someone coming into our offices 3 days after the election for a primary ballot, 7 days after the election for a general election ballot.
The time.
It's not only the time, it's the uncertainty.
I'm uncertain. How come every other state or most states count these? Or am I wrong in my question?
I wouldn't necessarily speculate with respect to any other state. I don't.
It just seems you've put forward interest that this is just going to make it very difficult for the district to operate in its election system.
I don't.
And it seems much less complicated than doing it in California or Florida or Texas.
It depends on their statutory scheme, Judge Kavanaugh. I don't know if California has the same type of write-in scheme where anybody at any time from any state can come to the District of Columbia, particularly for a presidential ballot, and say, I want to declare myself as a write-in up until 7 days after the election. And if we would engage in the exercise that the appellants would choose, we can't just limit it to the appellants. It would have to be an open system, and that, in the board's estimation, would be an equal protection violation if we're treating the appellants one way and not providing that same meaningful opportunity to anyone else. So it's not just the cost, it's the uncertainty of ever being able to finally certify our election results, which is our core and primary function.
What do you mean by ever? Certified? That there's some cutoff date.
When I say ever, I mean that we would never know at any election period how many people would be filing as a write-in candidate, and therefore we wouldn't have a certainty of knowing how long the process would take, how many people to employ to engage in a process. And when I say just the president, it's not just the president. We have 293 offices on every ballot at a minimum for the Advisory Neighborhood Commission position. So our ballot is unique in that we have a myriad of contests, as well as...
I think that makes it unique. That's true in a lot of places.
But again, I don't know how many states have or jurisdiction have the unique liberal write-in procedure that we have, being that the Supreme Court has said that there's no right to a write-in, no constitutional right to a write-in in the first place, from Burdick v. Takushi. So with respect to our particular statutory scheme...
In the district court, what was submitted suggests that 35 states allow write-ins for president. I don't know if that's true or not, but that was in one of the declarations in the district court.
So. Right. Even if they did, that we don't know, and it's not in the record, how that write-in scheme works. With respect to the appellants, they applied prior to the election, giving us the opportunity to know exactly who they were. However, a party could apply for write-in status after the election, up to 7 days after the election. So we would never know who our potential candidates are. We would never know who would be the person we would never know how many people we would have to employ to process this undertaking. And I believe that balancing and the burden would weigh far in our favor in terms of trying to figure out how to administer our election process, as opposed to knowing exactly how many votes.
Seems like it'd be pretty easy.
Pretty easy to?
To count.
The
write-in
votes?
1,100 votes here.
Correct.
You know.
We don't have any way of...
Take probably one person one day.
Actually, I don't believe that would be the case. We don't have any way of just... we don't... I was going to let you finish.
Yeah, well, if you do the math, I think you could get through a pile in a day.
But you wouldn't be it's not segregated that way. The ballots don't segregate for write-in contests.
Right.
So you'd have to...
have them segregated, yes.
So that would mean...
Yes,
it does. Yes, it does. As in the record, it would take several days to weeks, as the declaration of our executive director at the time, Ruki Suleiman, had positive.
Somehow these other states pull it off.
I don't know for a fact that they do pull it off and report their write-in results if they're not outcome determinative. That's not in the record. So I don't know. I can't speak or speculate to how any other jurisdiction would do it. But again, as I said earlier, our statutory scheme may be quite different in terms of write-in, the way to validate yourself as a write-in candidate, to where those other states may have a different system in place.
Do you know the answer to the question I asked Mr. Hall? Do you count absentee ballots if they won't make a difference?
Yes, we do. As we counted the write-in ballots, we would, and the absentee ballots are treated the same way. If someone writes in a name, we count the name as in the aggregate for that contest, just as we do
these are
a person that's in person.
Absentee ballots not necessarily, don't the absentee ballots have the names printed on them?
Yes, it's the exact same ballot that you would receive if you were in person.
Mm-hmm.
So they're treated the same, they just come in later. They come in up to 10 days later. And to emphasize the difference in that scenario, if you're an absentee voter, to not count your ballot is totally different from not itemizing who the write-in on any particular ballot is for. So we're dealing with apples and oranges. With respect to the cases that were raised by the appellants, we're dealing with apples and oranges. We're dealing with voting access and ballot access. which the appellants had. They had the right and opportunity to cast their vote for the person of their choice. Elections are, as you all know, anonymous and secret. Ballot choice is secret. They know whoever the parties are that voted for the write-in candidate, know who they voted for. And I don't know with respect to, I think there was pure speculation with respect to how prospective voters would try. There wasn't anything in the record saying that a prospective voter would be less inclined to vote for a write-in candidate or any candidate for that matter based on the fact that they don't know how many particular votes were garnered in the previous election.
Okay. Anything else? Okay, thank you. Did you have anything else?
No.
No. Mr. Hall, you are out of time, but you can have 1 minute if you'd like. Yeah. Oh, I'm sorry.
Yes, sorry.
My apologies. Thank you. Go ahead.
May it please the court, I'm James McKay, and I represent Mayor Gray and Attorney General Nathan. Just 2 points. First, under the test under Anderson and Burdick, you know the burden is slight, and therefore the undisputed administrative cost and the delay should be sufficient to justify this. The fact that other states may have different schemes is not the standard. The standard is whether or not the district's particular scheme is constitutional.
But it helps, at least me, it would help me assess whether what you're saying is really legitimate in the sense that if other states manage to report the individual write-in votes, then it really casts some doubt on how legitimate your claim of burden is in counting them and reporting them.
Judge Kavanaugh,
I guess no one really knows how it's done. The record doesn't disclose how it's done in other states. Do you know?
Well, the record does disclose that Alaska and Washington do have a very similar scheme where they do not count write-in votes if they're not going to possibly be determinative. And the record also shows 15 states just ban write-in votes entirely. The Burdick case in Hawaii
does not. 33, including some big ones that do the tallies?
Well, one thing I found out is each state has a very unique system of determining, you know, how people get on the ballot, and some are tougher than others. The district's probably in the middle, but I think that under the Burdick and Anderson test, we don't have to show that the district is, you know, easier than the norm or, you know,
I agree with that, but the cost thing, you're going to have, if you get a FOIA request, to go through these and figure out which ones have write-ins, right? You're going to have to segregate them.
Well, the one thing I should mention.
Is that true?
Well, if
you get a FOIA request, you're going to have to segregate the
write-ins. We would have to, under the FOIA, DC Code, I'd point this court to DC Code 2532B. It says that the cost can be waived if it's in the public interest of the agency. We could, you know, it's undisputed that the ballots are a public record to which people have access. They can inspect it. There's no charge to inspect a record. And they're, you know.
Actually, the question that Judge Kavanaugh is asking is, would you have to segregate the write-ins from the non? And I take it the answer is no.
You'd have to go through all.
Just listen to the question for 1 second. You could just give them all the ballots.
Yes.
And they could segregate them.
Correct, Your Honor.
There's nothing that requires in FOIA you to do any work other than turn over all the documents.
Absolutely, Your Honor.
You can flood them.
We could give them
not atypical response to FOIA requests.
Well, we could certainly we could make it as easy as possible and give them, you know, access to the ballot boxes, and they could go through them at their, you know, leisure. I mean, it would take a while, but it's not like they can't get
the information. This was done in Florida after the Bush versus Gore case. The newspapers created a consortium, I think, and actually looked at all the ballots and counted how they came out.
Well, they could do the same thing here. The point is that they don't. It's not like we're hiding the actual breakdown from them. It's available to them. They would have to undergo the time and energy to ascertain that. But given the fact that it's undisputed that it's non-determinative that they couldn't possibly have an effect on the election, even if they, assuming they want all 1,182 write-in ballots. So, because
you have an answer to Judge Garland's earlier hypothetical that was also raised by opposing counsel, which is, could you not count a ward if you had determined by counting the other wards that there was no way the last ward could matter or the last precinct could matter?
Well, that would violate very core fundamental First Amendment rights of those voters under the Anderson test. That would fail. The point is that in that case, it's totally distinguishable from this case because you were affecting very core First Amendment rights. In this case, the votes were counted. It was undisputed they could not have possibly had an effect in the election. And therefore, under the Anderson balancing test, the district's administrative cost and the uncertainty that would result in delay in certifying the results is sufficient to justify this rule. But I think it is, as Judge Garland mentioned, it is a balancing test. And I think when you apply the balancing test, in this case, the burden.
So teasing that out, the fact that it couldn't have an effect on the election really doesn't matter. It's whether it's counted or not.
Well, it's a combination of the fact that
it would. You agreed it would be a First Amendment violation or some kind of constitutional violation not to count a whole precinct.
Absolutely, Your Honor. It would be a violate the core fundamental rights of those voters not to have their votes counted. In this case, they were counted, and it's a fundamental distinction between a write-in ballot where you can write anybody you want and a ballot. When you're on the ballot, it's a very slight burden to get on the ballot. It's only 1%, and they have like 54 days under the statute. And I cite the DC Code 1001.08A1B and I4, that it basically you have 54 days to circulate the petitions, and you have to get about 1%. I think the record shows about 3,900 votes in those 54 days. So that's not a very heavy burden. I mean, Ralph Nader was on the ballot. Other people were on the ballot. And the overall ballot access scheme is fairly lenient. It's not severe or burdensome. And therefore, we believe that under the balancing test in Anderson, the board's rules are valid and constitutional, and they should be upheld. And therefore, we would ask this court to affirm the district court.
Thank you, Mr.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. So now we're back to Mr. Hall. You can have 1 minute if you'd like it.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'd like to make four quick points. First of all, this idea that the burden is slight because the ballot access scheme is easy is not factually accurate. As we've already discussed, the D.C. ballot scheme is more restrictive than all but, I think, four states in the nation. And also, we're talking about what happens when votes are cast and then they're treated unequally and stigmatized in the way that they are done here. And that is an independent burden from the question of how easy it is to get on the ballot. Second, with respect to FOIA, I've already mentioned there are several Supreme Court cases that say that you cannot require candidates and voters to shoulder the cost of holding elections. And so that FOIA remedy is a non-starter. And there are multiple lower courts that hold the same thing. The 11th Circuit in Fulani v. Krivenek said the same thing. The 3rd Circuit in Belitskis v. Pizzengrilli said the same thing. And multiple lower courts. Third point.
It turns out to be more expensive than I thought in the sense that it's not just for you. It would not just be counting the 1,500 write-ins. You'd have to go through all of the ballots to figure out which ones are write-ins.
That may be so. I don't know how this machinery would work. I only know what the Constitution requires, Your Honor.
Well, you have an affidavit in the record that says that. It's exactly what the board's affidavit said, that you would have to sort through all the ballots to find the write-ins.
Affidavit, Your Honor, also says that it would require training of new employees, and it doesn't really make a lot of sense when you consider that these are people who are lifelong elections.
You could have submitted an affidavit from an expert countering that, but you didn't do it.
That's correct, Your Honor. But I would simply reply that those statements are not really plausible on their face to suggest
that you could have found an expert and had your own affidavit.
An expert in how easy it is to count ballots in the D.C. Board of Elections. I suppose we could have found one. You're right. You're right. We didn't, but I would say those statements are not really plausible on their face. Okay. The idea that this requires...
It does count a little bit in your favor also, though. That would mean that the FOIA alternative would be expensive for you.
It would be expensive. It would also be unconstitutional. And again, the point here is that these are elections officials who are already engaged in the process of counting write-in votes. As a matter of fact, they do count the votes, as they repeatedly say. They just don't report who the votes were cast for.
The machine does that, right? The machine does that, right?
I'm not sure, Your Honor, because they said that the machine can't segregate these votes.
It can't segregate them by candidate, but it counts the ones that are write-ins, doesn't it? They know that there were 1,100 and some write-ins.
That may be true, but then, Your Honor, if that's the case, then why? I don't understand why a machine could count write-in votes, but could not then indicate which ones it had counted or
something. It doesn't scan them. I mean, all we have to go on is the affidavit.
Yeah.
And that's what the affidavit says. I think your problem here is that we have an affidavit in the record that explains this in some detail, and there's no evidence on the other side. So.
Well,
okay, your time is up.
Can I ask one question? Sorry, I had one question, which is when I asked the question about other states do report the number of votes a write-in candidate received in the district, or the election board council said, well, D.C.'s different because of the way the write-in candidates can get on the ballot or can the write-in candidates can ask to be counted. Can you respond to that? I wasn't sure I followed it, but can you respond to it?
Oh, the seven-day thing?
Yes.
Yeah, I thank you for raising that, Your Honor, because if the problem here is that after the election, I believe is what the representation was, is that after the election, anybody can walk in and file paperwork for up to 7 days and say, now I'm a declared write-in candidate. Well, if that's the problem, and that raises a lot of uncertainty, maybe that law should be changed. But the solution here is not to burden the voting rights of the voters who have already cast valid votes. And that points to the central issue in this case, which is what's needed here is neutral principles.
Well, let me just pause over that. If that's the answer to that, and if we were to rule in your favor here, could they just do the same thing Hawaii did and say anybody with less than 1%, no write-in at all?
Well, Your Honor, again, these all have to be taken in the context of the entire statutory scheme. In Hawaii, you could get on the ballot by submitting only 25 signatures or even 15 for some offices. That's not the case here. Despite what the board is representing, the district's ballot access scheme, it's undisputed, is more restrictive than all but four states. I believe it's four, it may be five. And that makes it a relatively restrictive ballot access scheme. And again, what is needed in this case is a neutral principle by which the board can articulate that we have decided not to count these valid votes. And the fact that they are not outcome determinative is not a neutral principle in the sense that it doesn't apply that to Republicans, it doesn't apply it to overseas votes, it only applies it to the write-in votes of declared write-in candidates and other write-in votes. But we're only talking about declared candidates and valid votes cast for declared candidates.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Case submitted. We'll call the next case.